He never shared anything with me. He had no interest in me at all, other than to make me feel small, to hurt me, to put me down. It was very important to me that I give my kids the entire opposite experience, that they were loved unconditionally, that they were supported, that they were nurtured, that they were cared for in ways that I wasn't.
Welcome to The Art of Fatherhood, a podcast that takes you on the journey of fatherhood. Now here's your host, Art Eddy.
What's going on, everybody? Art Eddy here for another edition of the Art of Fatherhood podcast. I'm so happy to have the one and only Will Wheaton. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me, sir. How you doing?
Hey, I'm very happy to be here.
Looking forward to chatting with you. I love the fact that you're doing kind of a revamp or retake on Still Just a Geek, and annotated memoir. We're going to be talking about that in a second, but I love bringing good guys like yourself to talk about fatherhood. So when you became a dad... What was going through your mind, sir?
I had already fallen in love with my wife, and I knew that she had kids, and I had been kind of like babysitting the kids and like being around them while we were dating. And I knew that if I was going to be in a relationship with her, I was going to be in a relationship with her children as well. And I also knew that I meant I was going to have to endure her ex-husband, who's a piece of crap. And I knew that it was going to be challenging, and I knew it was going to be a lot of work. And I took to it really well. I loved it. I loved and love being a dad. I absolutely love being a dad to my kids. I saw very quickly, Ann and I met when I was 23. She was 26. The kids were, I think, 3 and 5. And then we got married when I was, I think, 27 and Ann was 30. I think that's how it goes. And over the course of those years, I had completely accepted and fallen in love with both of the kids the exact same way. I learned how to be a dad on the job. You know, we can talk about this if you like, but the man who was my father is an asshole. He's a monster. He was a bully to me. He was awful to me. He never loved me unconditionally. He never shared anything with me. He had no interest in me at all, other than to make me feel small, to hurt me, to put me down. It was very important to me that I give my kids the entire opposite experience, that they were loved unconditionally, that they were supported, that they were nurtured, that they were cared for in ways that I wasn't. And in that effort, I kind of figured out that being a dad is a lot of hard work. And if it's not a lot of hard work, you're not doing it right. And if you're not willing to do the hard work, you better learn how to do the hard work, because if you can't, then there's going to be a kid out in the world for the rest of their lives who didn't have a dad. Yeah. And as one of those kids, it sucks.
Sorry to hear that, and everything that you were going through with your own relationship with your dad. And then also, too, I got to applaud you for breaking that cycle, because sometimes people, like, I'm not going to be like that, and they kind of, you know, revert back to what they've experienced. So anytime you hear those stories, especially here on my show, when, you know, dads talk about that, love the fact that you had the courage enough, and you put, like you said, the hard work to make sure that you were a good dad. Creativity, and I know just following your work and being a fan of yours, like being a good human, are certain things that you look to put out in the world. But talk about some of the other things you were looking
for. It is extremely important to me.
Yeah, exactly, man. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so glad to have you on the show. But talk a little bit about some of the other values or things you wanted to instill into them as they were growing up.
So I told my kids and instilled in them the values that I still talk to high schoolers and college kids about when I'm given the privilege of speaking to them. I wanted my boys to be honest, to be honorable, to work hard, to be kind, and to always do their best. And I wanted them to know that as their dad, they don't have to earn love from me. Like, I love them no matter what. They have done things that I was like, dude, what the come on, man. But that's just kind of part of life, you know? Like, that's just part of life. And when those moments happened in my own life, I was never allowed to forget them. They were really held against me. I was never allowed to make a mistake. I wanted my boys to know that these are all values I wanted them to work towards, and that if they chose to embrace them as the fundamental values of their life the way that I had, then I was going to be there with them to help them learn how to do that. I was never going to stop loving them no matter what. I was going to love them absolutely no matter what. I still love them no matter what. I'm crazy about them. But I really wanted them to have those values. I figured out at some point in my life that we tend to attract to ourselves the type of person we are. Kind people attract other kind people. Cruel people attract other cruel people. Dishonest people attract other dishonest people. It's just how it goes. You see familiar things. And for someone who is looking to, in one way or another, kind of prey on another person and sort of hurt them, if that's what you're doing, you're going to attract people who do that to you. And you may not even be aware of it. It was real important to me that my kids grow up being confident, kind, and gentle. Nice. With themselves and with other people.
That is spot on right there. Like, being gentle with yourself and other people, I think, is very key. Thank you very much for sharing. I got two more follow-up questions. We'll go into your book. And just chatting with you, it just seems like you're taking a look at fatherhood inside and out. So what is something that your sons have taught you, either about yourself or about life, that you'd like to share with me?
I'm a trauma survivor. And I also have a dog who you may be able to hear right now. I'm a trauma survivor. And one of the ways my trauma expresses itself is an inability to accept that I'm good at things. I spent a lot of my life just being told I was the worst at everything and that nothing I ever did was good enough. My sons have made it extremely clear to me. They've made the effort to make it clear to me that they really value me as their dad. And they both asked me to adopt them at different points in their lives. They both took my name. My older son, Ryan, told me when he asked me to adopt him, he said, "Listen, Will, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I am who I am. The writer, the sci-fi nerd, the guy who loves the things he loves, like, I am who I am because of you. You are more of a dad to me than my dad was, and I want to make it official. Will you please adopt me?" Oh, man. So several minutes later, when I had composed myself, I said, "Yes, of course, absolutely." But a thing that I've really learned from my kids is that I am enough. I'm enough for them. I have to let myself accept that if I'm enough for my kids and I know I'm enough for my wife, then you know what? I'm just enough. And that's a really important thing that I want people to understand. I talk about it in my writing a lot. It doesn't come up a bunch in this book because I hadn't really kind of put this thinking into my head when the book was written originally 20 years ago. But like, we're all enough. It's so important for us to understand that. And for us as dads, for us to make sure our children know, like, y'all are enough. Like, you don't have to do a thing. Like, I can feel proud of you. That's great. But I love you no matter what. And you're enough. Occasionally you do a super cool thing. That's great. Good for you. I love it. I'm so happy for you. That's great. But you were enough. Just existing is enough for me. And as a son, I never felt that way. So to get that from my kids, that acknowledgement that you know, they're in their 30s now. And they're both real close to their mom and me. We talk all the time. I think we really earned that through love and communication. And I learned from them that accepting the love of another person in sometimes is more for them than it is for you. It's so important that we give our kids what they need. Yeah. And sometimes one of the things our kid needs is to know, I see how much you love me. It reflects the way I love you. And I want you to know how good that feels.
Powerful and beautiful stuff that you were sharing right there. And I think you said, like, having your kids' love and respect is a privilege. And, you know, and just everything you've experienced, you know, growing up and now as a dad, and just hearing, you know, they said, like, I'm able to be who I am because of, you know, watching your footsteps and watching your actions, Will. Like, that's so powerful. So thank you very much for sharing that. I know a lot of dads who are listening to this who are stepdad or adopted kids. My podcast tries to, like, include everybody's story and share, like, Will did this, Art did this. I'm kind of similar with Art in this realm and Art, you know, Will in that realm. So I really thank you for sharing that.
If I may, I would just love to just take 1 second and just say to my fellow stepdads, I really see you. I know. I get it. I absolutely get it. I see you. I love you. I respect you. It's real hard work. Real, real, real hard work. Do not ever, 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 ever let your kids end up in a place where they are the spoils of war or some kind of weapon that adults are using to hurt each other. It's so important. That goes for all parents, but for step parents especially.
Yeah, never treat your kids as pawn in some type of game, right? So I
Yeah.
totally agree with you, man. I think a lot of things that people that you said people can take in and digest and be like, oh, that's I should do that, or maybe I could put that into who I am as a father. But do you have a dad hack or a piece of advice you'd like to offer to new dads or just dads in general that you were like, you know what, this is a pretty good dad hack or this worked for me?
You're gonna screw up. You're gonna do a thing that really hurts your kid. You're not gonna mean it. Something's gonna happen. You're gonna carelessly say something. You're gonna be tired. You're gonna be worn down. You're gonna be on your last nerve. Like just you, and in that moment, you have a short, brief kind of like failing of like, you know, being that person you really aspire to be. When that happens, number one, accept it and own it, but don't beat yourself up. Don't spend time wallowing in there. Number two, and this is the most important thing. Nothing is more important than this. Set aside a very special moment with your kid who you have inadvertently hurt. Sit down or do whatever it is you do together. And that's when you've got to say, as the dad, listen, I, you know, like I'm a person and this is really important. You need to know this. I know I'm your dad. And as you get older and as things change, you're gonna eventually get this. I'm a person like you're a person, and people mess up. What's really important here is that when we mess up, we tell the person who we hurt that we are sorry. We tell them why we're sorry. We acknowledge what we did, and we learn how to not do that in the future. And when that happens, we accomplish two things as a father. We model behavior for our kid that's really good, really positive behavior, right? Like, there's a real good chance that a kid whose parent has said, I really messed up when I said that thing, and I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to do that. There is a real good chance that kid goes back to a kid at school or at the park or daycare or whatever, and is like, hey, listen, we were playing yesterday, and I said blah, 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 and I think it made you feel bad, and I didn't mean to do that, and I'm sorry. Or, yeah, you know what? I was feeling really bad and I was like, what's a terrible thing to say? And I said it, and now I really regret it, and I'm really sorry about that. So we model that, but also we show that it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to screw up. We're fallible. And what matters is not that you didn't make a mistake. What matters is you made a mistake. You learned from how the mistake was made, and you try hard in the future not to make the same mistake again.
100% agree. Great piece of advice. Thank you very much for sharing that. And like I said earlier, congrats on Still a Geek, an annotated memoir. I love the
Thanks.
fact that you took a look at, you know, what you wrote back in like 2009 when the book came out, and now and kind of off air we were talking a little bit about like how this was a labor of love. Talk
Yeah.
about what inspired you to kind of like, you know, do a retrospective on like your first book and be like, this is where I'm at now. I love the concept, sir.
Oh, thank you. I wish I could say it was my idea. It wasn't. I had actually written a novel, and I had a semi-autobiographical novel, and I had gotten it to a point where I realized it's not going to get any better. Like, I've gotten this as far as I can get it. I really need an editor with experience to help me figure it out. I need like a senior advisor, or you know, like somebody to help me get the just I've gotten as far as I can get it. So my agent shopped it, and the entire world of capital P publishing, and like every publisher was like, nope, rejected. And they didn't even re they, like they thought so little of it that they didn't even like offer notes. They were just like, nope, not interested. But one editor, David Pomerico, said, I have an idea. I really liked your book, Just a Geek, that was published in 2004. And for your listeners, if they don't know what that is, it's the first book that I wrote. It was a collection of blog posts that I had written at willwheaton.net in the early 2000s when blogging was new and novel and social media didn't exist. And this was a book that was kind of about the story of building that, expressing myself through it, and working through some childhood trauma and regret in a way that I did not realize at the time was incomplete. So David liked this book, and he said, here's the thing, there's some problematic stuff in it. There's places where you're insensitive, there's places where you're glib, there's places where you're frankly offensive. I would just love for you to look at this because I like who you are now, and I think you probably have something interesting to say about it. So I went back and looked at it, and I saw this person who was clearly a trauma survivor, who is clearly an abuse survivor, who was trying very hard to get his parents to see him and find his way through an incredibly difficult industry with a lot of difficult things going on. And in the revisiting of it, I saw how much I had grown since I had initially written it. And I really did have a lot to say about it. I felt, look, this was published, like, you know, 11 people read it or whatever, but like it was still published. It's in the world. I need to hold this version of myself accountable for like being sexist and for just being homophobic and insensitive. If you had asked that kid then, he would have been like, oh my God, I didn't mean that at all. But I just didn't know. Yeah. Now I do. And I think that I didn't know only works until you know. Once you know, you no longer get to fall back on, I didn't know. Great, I know. What are you going to do about it? And David said, I would love for you to revisit this and annotate it and look at it and talk about things. And I was like, I think that's a great idea. I'd love to do that. So I got into it. And I started going through it and I started pulling out pieces of it and I started looking at pieces of it and I started that annotation process. And I said to David, like, if there's things that stand out to you that you want me to talk about, highlight them for me and we'll do it. And we got through it. So I went through all of it. It took about a year. It was incredibly emotional. I had to really confront in a very clear-eyed and challenging way the reality that I never had a mom, I had a manager I couldn't fire, and I never had a dad. I had a bully my whole life. Knowing that about myself now, I could really see the pain that I was living in when I wrote Just a Geek. So I was able to talk about a lot of that and contextualize it and atone and own up and all that. And then the back half of the book is all essays I have written about things I love: Star Trek, being a dad, being a geek, being a gamer, living with mental health. I speak really openly and unselfconsciously and unashamedly about my mental illness. I have depression, anxiety, and PTSD. And I'm not ashamed about any of that. Like, I didn't choose it. It just happened to me. Yeah. And we're going through the book allows me to tell a lot of that part of my story. And it is my hope that the wide reading audience who receives this will receive it the same way the group of beta readers I gave it to, where they said, like, gosh, I really felt like I can really see the person you are, and I can see why you are, and I can see instances in my own life where I have unaddressed trauma and unresolved trauma. And I kind of hope that I hope it's entertaining. I mean, there's parts where, you know, I think I'm reasonably funny from time to time, but also like, I really hope that I hope that it is in a way that it's healing for people the way it's been healing for me.
Spot on. I think now more than ever in this day and age, you always think like, why are we still in this place? Or why are we still having this methodology? Or why are people still acting this way, right? And I think sometimes people aren't open to seeing their own faults. And I think with you and your family's dynamic, where you're open and saying, like, I made a mistake, same thing with me and my wife and my daughters. There's an issue and I'll be like, I'm not perfect, I'm sorry. And I'm never 100% like always that perfect, trying to strive for that perfection. But I think we need self-reflection. And I think this book, like, everyone, you know, has like these self-help books, and you see all, and to everybody, if they want to like do like their inner, you know, Instagram coaching and all this other stuff. But I think this book is needed right now, just in the sense of like, you are sharing your ups and downs and what you thought, you know, back in 2004. And now you're like, man, that was probably not the best take. Accountability, yeah. And just, you know, saying you're sorry, I think needs to happen more for everybody, myself include everything. But I really feel like people need to have this book to, I think, I, like you said, your hope is like not only will they see your journey, but everybody can reflect on their journey. And I'm glad that you had people, you know, check out the book and all that. What has helped you while writing this book just kind of maybe get over something that, you know, you didn't, you thought that maybe you're over, maybe you didn't think about it. Was there something that in your life where you got over that while you're writing this book, being like, thank God for this book, because now I'm able to like say like, I'm no longer hung up on this, or this thing is not going to attack me anymore.
Yes, that is an extremely, you have no idea how relevant that question is to where I am at this precise moment in my life. I am on day like 6, 7, or 8 of doing the audiobook of Still Just a Geek. I've been reading it every day. I've been working with a director who I've worked with for a decade, who I know very well, who actually lived with me through a lot of the stuff that I talk about in this book. I feel really comfortable with her. I can be vulnerable with her. I can trust that if I allow myself to feel emotion too much and it's too intense, that she will say, I get that. We should really pull it back because it might make the listener uncomfortable. Or like, hey, I feel like, are you aware that you wrote this thing that's really clever, but the way you're delivering it, you're kind of like, you're not really, you're only getting like to 8 out of the 10 possible points you can get on this thing. I'm like, oh my gosh, I didn't even realize that, right? There is a moment in the original Just a Geek where I am relating a story about the time I met a childhood hero who was unkind to me when I was a kid. And it was really hurtful for a ton of reasons that were exacerbated by the trauma I was living with that I was not aware of. There is a moment in the retell, in the telling of the story, where a friend of mine wants me to say, is like, whoa, what happened? And I say in the narration, I hesitated. I didn't want to say it out loud because saying it out loud would make it real. When I have read Still Just a Geek, which involved reliving Just a Geek, I have spent all this time with a younger version of myself who was struggling, who was in incredible pain, who was really unsure kind of where he was going and what he wanted to do with himself. And as I annotated that, I got to do this thing that my therapist has kind of helped me with as I go through, as I work through healing like my PTSD and stuff. When there are these moments of extreme pain and stress from childhood, you have to sort of cognitively separate adult me from child me. And then as I recall those things, adult me is there for child me the way no one was at the time. So it is adult me saying to 7-year-old me, 14-year-old me, 16-year-old me, 24-year-old me, come here, buddy, I'm here. I know, I get it. And I'm going to put my arms around you and just hold you. And like, you don't have to carry this anymore. I'm going to take it from you. I wrote all of that. When I got to the end of the book, after a nearly 2-year process, I wrote an afterword. And one of the things I say in the afterword is, I got to be honest with you, I expected a real catharsis to happen while I worked on this. And I didn't get it. I got re-traumatized a lot. I have a lot of kind of like intellectual information I can process, but the catharsis, the healing isn't there because I hadn't said it out loud. In the recording of the audiobook, I have been 28-year-old me saying the things I wrote as 28-year-old me. I have also been 49-year-old me looking back on 28-year-old me and just saying like, that's not cool. You're really going to regret this thing. And, oh, buddy, I'm so sorry. Like, I see it. You didn't see it, but I sure see it. Like, I get it. I totally, totally see you. So working on the audiobook, I have said it all out loud. And over the last 6, 7, 8 days, I have physically felt weight leave my body. I have felt pain and trauma and sadness. And most importantly, the thing I'm the most ashamed of, the rage, the just incandescent rage. How dare they do these things to me? It's all, it's not there anymore. And I think a big, big part of that has been reading this out loud and feeling all of it in my body, feeling the stuff that's great, feeling the stuff that's sad, feeling the stuff that's regretful, feeling the stuff that there's a German word and I can't remember what it is. My friend told it to me a couple of days ago. It's perfect. It essentially means when you experience the joy of a thing and you experience a certain amount of the joy, but you simultaneously experience an equally powerful and poignant and meaningful sadness that the thing you feel great about is ending or is not going to be permanent or whatever. It's these two things together. You can't have one without the other. You have to have them both together. The closest we come in English is like bittersweet, but that doesn't even come with like, that's not within like 40 stadiums of where the freaking German word is. And I wish I could remember what it was. That's where I am now.
Yeah.
And it's been incredible. It's been really incredible. In Just a Geek, I write a lot about these twin characters I kind of created, which as it turns out, were just giving voices and anthropomorphic characters to the way my dad and mom treated me. One's called the voice of self-doubt, who tells me I'm terrible at everything. And one's called proof to everyone that quitting Star Trek wasn't a mistake. Because I really felt like, oh, my parents resent that I quit Star Trek because it made me not famous. And I have to show them that I'm worthy, you know?
Yeah.
Reading this, narrating it, voicing it, experiencing it, reliving it, working with Gabrielle, my director, on all of it has been as magnificently healing as literal years of weekly therapy sessions.
I'm very happy for you. And it just sounds like a weight has been lifted. Like you said, I'm going to look up that German word. My youngest is like she wants to take German in high school, whatever the case may be, but I appreciate you sharing that. Two more questions before we end off with a fatherhood quick five, you know,
okay.
You know, Star Trek, Stand By Me, Big Bang Theory, all this stuff, you know, acting and all that good stuff. But like, coming up on you, I know that you're a big fan of writing. When did that passion of writing begin? Was it on a set? Did you see like when you're reading a script and all this other stuff, you're like, oh, this is the path. Like, where did the love of writing come from?
I was around 10, maybe 11. I started writing short stories just by hand. You know, I created a couple of characters that were just analogs of Tom and Jerry and put them through adventures. Then I started writing. I loved The Twilight Zone. So I watched The Twilight Zone and then I would write the story I had just seen. I would write it myself. You know, I would do the dialogue. I would do the descriptions. I would do all of it. And I would write it the way that I wrote that. I would write it the way I imagined the authors I enjoyed reading would write it. I did all of that when I was a kid. Then I did Stand By Me. And the character I played in Stand By Me was a writer. And during the press for Stand By Me, I was asked every time, are you a writer like your character? And the thing is, I was.
Yeah.
But that just felt like, that felt like Hollywood bullshit. It felt like if I was like, well, I mean, I am.
Yeah.
But, you know, but I'm not. As I got a little bit older and worked on Star Trek and then worked on Toy Soldiers. And then around the time I was like 18 and my mother couldn't legally control me. She still emotionally controlled me, but I had like a lot of my own agency then. I started just writing short stories for myself. I never showed them to anyone. I probably never will. But I just kept feeling like I don't enjoy this acting thing. I really don't. I love the storytelling. I love the writing. I love the art and the performing of all of it. Like what I loved was writing a thing and then performing the thing that I wrote. I was crazy about it. I really fought that because I had been groomed by my mother to believe that the only thing I could do, the only thing I was meant to do, and in fact, the only thing that I should do was be not an actor, be a famous actor. And with writing, that was just me. It was quiet. It was alone. It was fun. I could make stuff up, and like I was the king of the world when I was doing all of that. And around the time I started my blog, which would have been around 2000, just right around the beginning of the millennium, I said it out loud for the very first time. I said it to Anne, my wife. We'd only been married for a year. And I said, I just want to be a writer. And I don't know if I'm going to be any good at it, but it's a thing I really want to do. I really want to learn how to tell a story with a beginning and a middle and an end. A lot of that growth process and that journey from actor who sometimes writes to full-time writer who occasionally acts when it's fun or cool, a lot of that story is told in Still Just a Geek. Right. A lot of that journey is covered at a much more macro level. A couple of nights ago, I was sitting in my game room. Want to give a note to 10-year-old me. Will, you grow up and you have a game room that's full of board games. But hold on, buddy. It has 4 arcade machines in it. The only reason you don't have a pinball machine is because you don't have room. This is the life you get to live. So like, hold on, buddy. You're going to get there and it's going to be amazing. So I'm playing Donkey Kong. And I think the next book involves me playing Donkey Kong. It's at a point in the creative process where if I were to tell you where I feel it is at the moment, I'm going to lose the momentum to get it finished. It'll stop being whatever it's going to be and start being the thing I said right now it needs to be, right? So I was sitting out there playing Donkey Kong. I'm thinking about this thing that I'm working on writing. And I'm like, a couple of phrases are in my head. And I'm like, sort of like saying some of the things out loud to see how they feel and how they sound. And I realized I'm writing this book no matter what. And I don't care if nobody reads it. I'm writing it because it's going to be fun and it's going to be therapeutic and it's going to be interesting. And I just don't care if I don't care if nobody buys it. I just want to write the book. That was when I knew I'm a writer. I'm a host. I'm a producer. I'm a voice actor. I'm an audiobook narrator.
Which you do spectacularly, by the way.
I do.
Thanks,
man.
What am I blanking on it? Ready Player One? Dude.
Thanks, buddy.
You were meant for that role. Just saying, that was awesome.
Man, so real quick, when I first read that, I was like, oh my God, this guy is me. And when Ernie asked me to narrate it, I couldn't believe it. Oh my God. I love it. I'm incredibly proud of it. I'm so grateful that it is part of my life. But that's one of the things I do, right? Those are my jobs. I love those jobs. They're great. My passion, the thing that I do those jobs so that I can support the passion, is writing and telling stories. And if people happen to want to share the things that I've written, if professionals think, yes, this is interesting outside of your head, as it turns out, that's really great. But if it's not, it's an actor. There are actors who are willing to just audition to death and never book auditions. They're willing to do a play for no money that they have to pay for with 6 people in theater because it feels so good to be on stage, because it feels so good to be part of a company. I have felt that. I know what that feels like.
Yeah.
But that good feeling doesn't outweigh the stuff about it that I just don't like. But for writing, I'm willing to do anything for writing. There are times where my wife is like, do you want to go blah, 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 blah? And I'm like, I have an idea and I got to get it down. And if I stop now, I'm going to lose it. Maybe I can meet you, whatever. I carry the notebook in my pocket all the time. I'm constantly writing stuff down. That is who I am. And knowing that is very freeing and liberating. It feels really, really good.
Love it, man. Before we finish off the Fatherhood Quick Five, it's not really a question. I just want to share my thanks and my gratitude for this. With the internet, there's always good things and bad things, but I showed my daughters this. I showed my friends this. The Comic-Con, I think it was like back in 2013, where this girl asks you about being a nerd, maybe being picked on. Chef's kiss for your answer, man. I'm getting goosebumps right
Oh,
now thinking that,
thanks,
like,
man. Thank you.
that is just like I said, chef's kiss. So I just wanted to say, from one geek to another, that what you said to her was perfection, dude.
That little girl is now a young woman, and she reached out to me, and she told me what that meant to her, and she told me how it affected her life in a positive way. She told me how she's doing these things that she's crazy about that she absolutely loves. And one of the reasons she says she can do them is because of that talk. And I'm not taking ownership of that at all. What I am saying is, I'm so incredibly grateful that I got to be part of someone's story in a way that made their life better.
It's beautiful, man. Thanks. You've been so gracious with your time, and I appreciate your thoughts on fatherhood and just writing in the book and everything. Now we'll finish off with the Fatherhood Quick Five. Favorite family movie? Do you guys have one?
Well, it would probably be A Christmas Story. We watch it. It's a Wheaton family tradition. We turn it on in the morning on Christmas Eve and leave it on repeat until the afternoon on Christmas Day. It's a movie I auditioned for, so the kids get to hear that story. We have one of those Department 56 village things that's built out of buildings from the movie. We have the flagpole with the kids' tongues stuck to it. That's probably the super family movie that we always watch together.
Nice, man. Favorite song, or was there a band or an artist you couldn't wait to introduce them to when they got to a certain age to appreciate it?
I was incredibly excited to share jazz with Ryan. He took a jazz class in his freshman year at college, and it was very early jazz, almost like Dixieland kind of jazz. And the jazz that I had exposed him to was Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Dave Brubeck, Oscar Peterson, and he didn't get it. He just didn't like it. What's really sweet and wonderful about this is when I was working on Next Generation, Jonathan Frakes tried to introduce me to jazz the same exact way, and I absolutely didn't get it. One of the things that we absolutely love, that we absolutely share together, is my love of punk rock. And my love of big grunge and 90s alternative rock. So, a number of years ago, I got to take Ryan to a concert where we got to see the Reverend Horton Heat and the Damned and X all together.
Nice.
It was incredible. I couldn't believe that I got to share with my son three bands that at various moments in my life were the entire world to me.
Nice. Love it, man. Describe the perfect family vacation. Where would it be?
I haven't seen both of my kids together since the beginning of the pandemic, and that sucks. I miss the hell out of both of them. I've seen Ryan a couple of times, but I haven't seen Nolan at all. At this point, the perfect family vacation is wherever we can all be together.
Beautiful. Hope you guys get that soon.
Me too.
Favorite thing, book, game, whatever the heck, like board game that you're geeking on right now, what is it?
I am playing to death career mode of NHL 22 on the PlayStation 4. So I created a character. His name is Blaine Gretzky. He wears number 98. I honestly wish I'd named him Shane Gretzky, but his name is Blaine Gretzky.
Wayne Gretzky's so much better.
I was like, what rhymes with Wayne but starts with A? Nothing. What rhymes with Wayne but starts with B? Blaine, I'm done. He wears number 98. He wears a Jofa helmet. He's in the playoff run for his second season. He was drafted first overall by the Seattle Kraken. He's in his second season. I document his career on my Instagram stories. He's a real player. He wears a goatee because he's from the Mirror Universe. He's actually Wayne Gretzky's evil twin from the Mirror Universe. Because unlike Wayne Gretzky, he fights all the time. Like, he has over 300 penalty minutes, and the second place person with most penalty minutes has like 80. It's been great. And the thing that's real fun about it is Ryan and I share that. Ryan has his own installation of NHL 22. And he plays a character. I can't remember his character's full name, but his announcer name is Dick. So, like, they're like, and the Dick gets the pass. Like, it's hilarious because my son and I are just 12 years old when we do stuff like this together. So that's kind of what I'm obsessed with, is like playing Blaine Gretzky's career. And I play one or two games a day. I put it on my Instagram story. It's silly. I have friends that are like, I am incredibly invested in Blaine Gretzky's career. and that's been really, really, really super fun. And then the other thing that I'm just really spending all of my time with right now is Donkey Kong. I'm really like, I could go on forever about the things that I have learned and come to understand about this game. And that's really where I'm spending a lot of my time right now.
Nice. NHL 22, my kids and I love playing that game, and we loved like hearing the different, whoever's home, like the you know, when you score a goal, we love hearing the music. My daughter's like,
yeah,
you just can't wait to hear the different music. And then like, there was one from the Toronto Maple Leafs where like it was like an 80s like pop rock band, and you see like
amazing
people just like dance. It's just hilarious. So I love that. I love that game, man.
I love it when Blaine Gretzky has the puck in a visiting team like out of town on the road, and the whole crowd boos him. I'm like, oh, fuel me with your hatred. It only makes me stronger. There's also a guy, there's a Kraken fan who has a mohawk, and he paints his face, and he comes to every single home game and every single away game. I've decided that he's actually dating one of the players. I don't know who it is. And I love that he's there to support his man. I think it's incredible. I love that. I love that dedication. I would love to know more about whatever their story is. It's silly. It's so silly, but it's so much fun. And my friend Carlin is Carlin Baith in the game. So I saw her a couple of nights ago, and I was like, Carlin, oh my God, you love Blaine Gretzky's spinorama move. And Carlin goes, oh, when he uses that zone ability to turn away and move the play on, it's like, she just like, yes, anded the exact line from the game. And I was just like, Carlin, you're amazing. I wish I was recording this. It's such a good moment.
Awesome, man. I love it. And lastly, top three words you hope your sons would use to describe you as a dad. What would you want them to be?
Supportive, loving, awesome.
Nice. Love it. Great three words. People, make sure you follow Will on Twitter at WILW. And also, you're on the same on Instagram as well, right?
I am. So actually, I left Twitter a number of years ago. The account is still there. I've kept it active. I found Twitter to be a pretty toxic environment. I got real tired of Twitter not taking bullies seriously and kind of just being like, oh no, fascists use Twitter. What are we going to do? I was just like, okay, that's enough. I'm not supporting your platform anymore. But on Facebook and Instagram, I'm It's Will Wheaton.
Cool.
And then my blog is at willwheaton.net. You can find all of my info there. I'm very easy to find.
And definitely pick up Still a Geek, an annotated memoir. It's such a good read. Thank you. You've been so generous with your time. Thank you so much. And I wish you and your family continued success, and have fun playing Donkey Kong in NHL 22.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed speaking with you. Stay healthy and stay safe. I'll talk to you again.
Cool. Take care. Thanks for checking out this week's edition of the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Please rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And also go to artoffatherhood.net. You can have a chance to check out some great articles like the weekly Dad's Doing It Right column, the Collector of the Week, and many more. Plus, you have a chance to win some very cool prizes like video games, collectibles, all that good stuff. Go to artoffatherhood.net. And please make sure you rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, because I'll greatly appreciate it to get the word out on the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and go to artoffatherhood.net.